If you stop for just a moment and think about it, every other question in the world hinges on the answer to this one. Because if there really is a creator, then that means your life has purpose. That means that basically you are here for a reason. But if there is no God, then quite literally, you're just the result of a cosmologic accident. You are, as one person put it, the result of countless errors and biochemical morons. You see, folks, this one question, if you really think about it, you think about things like baptism, and you think about things like, do we come to church on Sunday? How do we live? Everything pales to this one question. Is there really a God? I want you to consider the following math for just a moment. I'm not a math guy, but I want you to look at these three little equations. Number one, only bodies that have a component that is eternal, for instance, a spirit, only bodies which have a component which is eternal and endless can have meaning. Because folks, let's face it, if when you die, everything is over, then you really don't have a whole lot of meaning. You're dead like Rover, dead all over. Number two, if there are no gods, then there are no endless lives. Because who instills the spirit? Number three, if there is no God, then ultimately lives have no meaning. Now, you may not like my math, but ultimately, folks, that doesn't change the fact that without God, life doesn't have a meaning. So I want you to think about the main questions of life that we've all asked, either maybe verbally or subconsciously. We wonder, where did we really come from? Why are we here? Where are we going when we die? The way in which we answer those questions depends a lot on our view towards this being. You know, we have a generation of folks who believe in a God, and in fact, they still believe that the whole duty of man is to fear God and keep His commandments. But I need you to understand tonight, we have now been training two generations of people in our educational system that there really isn't a God. And that basically the reason we are on this earth is to simply eat, drink, and be merry. So to begin with this evening, what I want you to do is I want you to consider your worldview. And by your worldview, I simply mean kind of how you perceive everything. If you want to think of it this way, it's kind of like your glasses or your sunglasses. There are lots of different types of worldviews out there. Tonight, I want us to focus on just two. Either a biblical worldview or a secular, or we could call it a societal worldview. As you look at those two, I want you to think, as we begin, which one you think you fall in. Most people automatically assume, well, you know, I've got a biblical worldview. Let's look at that a little closer for just a minute. If you look at the left-hand side of the screen, for people who have a true biblical worldview, when it comes to the topic of truth, ultimately they know that all truth comes from God, period. It doesn't matter what CNN tells them or what Time magazine says, ultimately there's only one place to find truth, and that's from God. Number two, they know if they have a biblical worldview that man was created in the image and likeness of God. And so even though Time magazine may show you one of those alleged missing links, Neanderthal man, they know deep down that that is garbage, and hopefully that's where they put it. Number three, if you've got a biblical worldview, folks, when it comes to the topic of ethics, you know that whatever God deems is good is ultimately good. And whatever He deems is bad, is bad. And if you have a true biblical worldview, you understand that your opinion doesn't really matter when it comes to ethics. What about the universe? Folks, if you've got a biblical worldview, you understand completely the universe was created by God, displays His handiwork, and ultimately allows us to tell signs and seasons to mark time. And last but not least, if you really do have a biblical worldview, you know that wisdom, true wisdom, comes from God. Now let's look at the flip of that for just a moment. What if you've got a secular worldview? If you've got a secular worldview, then basically you believe that there is no such thing as absolute truth. You've got your truth and I've got my truth. And basically I'm basing my truth on whatever I've been through my life. And who are you to tell me that my truth is wrong? Because ultimately there is no such thing as an absolute truth. Now, I realize there are some older people in here who look at that and you think to yourself, that's crazy. But I need you to understand we are indoctrinating our students with this idea today. And the reason that I can say that with such confidence, I went to a classroom setting and I was teaching a group of 9th to 11th graders. And we were talking about basically God and some different things. And I mentioned historical figures. So I start talking about people like Abraham Lincoln, Andrew Jackson. And a young man about three rows back, he looks at me, he says, we don't know any of those people existed. To which I paused and I kind of looked at him. I said, okay, well, you know, like George Washington. And I started rambling off three or four other historical figures. This young man shakes his head, he looks at me, he says, we don't know any of those people really lived. To which the entire class then kind of speaks up and says, yeah, we can't know any of that. So, you know, by this time, I'm thinking I'm in the twilight zone. This young man, emboldened by his classmate, sticks his chest out, looks at me in the eyes. He says, we can't know anything. To which I went over and I pinched him as hard as I could. And when he said, ouch, I said, how do you know that hurt? You see, folks, he bought it. He had drank the Kool-Aid, so to speak, on this idea that there really wasn't any kind of absolute truth. Number two, if you've got a secular worldview, you believe, probably subconsciously, that yeah, maybe we did evolve from some ape-like creature. Now, you may not say that aloud, but deep down in your heart of hearts, you kind of wonder. If you've got a secular worldview, when it comes to ethics, it is whatever makes you feel good that you deem is right. When it comes to the universe, if you've got a secular worldview, then you have bought into what we call the Big Bang Theory. The idea that once there was nothing out into space and then that nothing exploded. And we got everything around us today. And last but not least, if you have a secular worldview, you believe that ultimately wisdom comes from some man in front of you with a lot of initials after his name. Probably wearing a white starched lab coat, who has abandoned God a long time ago. Now, moms, dads, grandparents, listen to me very carefully. Here's the problem. In our homes, we try to establish the one on the left. I would point out, by the way, we're not doing a good enough job, but we at least try. Then our kids run off to school, and they get 4 years of indoctrination with what's on the right. Now granted, they still may have a belief in God. But here's what I'm seeing. They basically try to take a funnel. And they basically try their very best to squeeze God into that secular worldview. And it's not working. Because folks, if you think about it for just a moment, with God, there is truth. With God, there is an ethical standard. With God, there is purpose. Now, as you look at that and you think about that for just a moment, and you start analyzing what really is my worldview, I want you to think about how has society affected your worldview. My wife and I, we try to go on dates every other Tuesday, date night. Kind of a fun event to be able to go out and talk about something a little bit more exciting than Barney or Sesame Street or whatever. Most of the time at the end of our date night, we will end up at one of two places, either a coffee shop or a bookstore. On one particular occasion, we ended up at a at a Barnes & Noble there in just outside of Nashville, Tennessee. She went her way, I went mine. I walked by this end cap that said, thought-provoking. So I kind of stopped, I looked. Lo and behold, every single one of the books on that end cap is promoting atheism. Now, folks, think about that for just a moment. Why is that thought-provoking, and why does that deserve center stage, so to speak? And if that weren't enough, then our kids, you think about it from just a moment, from their perspective, they're hearing about what all their peers are reading. You ask the common teen, 19, 18 years age, they know about Christopher Hitchens. He wrote a book called God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. In fact, most of them know the name Richard Dawkins, very well-known atheist, who wrote a book called The God Delusion just a few short years ago. He's got a new one out now. Victor Stinger wrote a book called God, The Failed Hypothesis. Sam Harris, well-known atheist. He wrote a book called The End of Faith. Now, I would point out to you, these books are on the New York Times bestseller list. They're right there when you walk in. And our kids know about them. Not only that, they maybe stumble across a website like the one you see on the screen. Maybe they're doing a little research for a paper. They stumble across a website that says the Rational Response Squad. Well, that sounds good until you read the subtitle that says, believe in God? We can fix that. You see, folks, God is under attack in our culture today. In fact, let me share with you exactly what I mean when I say God is under attack. We go, for instance, to Lebanon, Tennessee, where a school system got fined $171,000. Their crime? They had allowed a group of parents to come together and pray for their kids each morning. One kid goes home, tells his atheist dad. Dad sues. $171,000 praying parents had to disband. Or we could go to Dixon County High School where a teacher gave an assignment. She said, I want you to write a paper using four sources. So some of the kids wrote about things like reincarnation. Some of them wrote about things like the occult. One young lady named Brittany Settle, she decided she would write her paper on Jesus Christ. She gave her four sources, and yet because of the topic, she received a zero. Or we could talk about a publishing company, Wiley Blackwell. Wiley Blackwell published a four-volume hardback set on the Encyclopedia of Christian Civilization. And then they recalled all of those books because they were told it was too Christian, that it was too orthodox, that it was too anti-secular. Notice this, it was too anti-Muslim. And not politically correct enough to be used in universities. Or we could talk about James Arnett. In fact, some of you in here, I'm sure, probably are familiar with this case. A confessed serial child rapist. Now, I'm going to restate that to make sure everybody heard what I said. This guy had confessed to raping several children. Obviously, the man is guilty. During one of his sentencing phases, a judge casually referenced Matthew chapter 18, verses 5 and 6, where it talks about you would be better off if a millstone were hung around your neck. And because a judge referenced that, a Bible scripture, that sentencing was thrown out. Or we could talk about a law that is now in place on the books in Colorado. Colorado, they passed a law that basically says this. If you are going to form new construction, let's say you're going to build a coffee shop. By law in Colorado now, you have to offer gender-neutral restrooms. Meaning restrooms where males and females will use the same facilities at the same time. You say, why in the world would they do that? Colorado is actually one of the places where transgender surgery, sex changes, it's one of the big hubs. And those people who were transgendered petitioned the court. They said, hey, we're not sure if we're supposed to go on the male or the female. And the court said, you're absolutely right. That's unfair. So what we're going to do is we're going to make them all neutral. Now you look at that and you say, there's no way. I'm a Christian. I'm not going to build a coffee shop and have some 60-year-old man following behind a 5-year-old little girl. Well, folks, if you don't do it, there's a $5,000 fine and up to a year in prison. Then you look at that and you say, Brad, they can't do that. I mean, after all, this is the United States of America. And yet, folks, they're already doing it. The great state of California has actually paved the way by already removing some of the little boys and the little girls signs from their restrooms. And now little boys and little girls use exactly the same facility at the same time. Now, you look at that and you think, what in the world is going on? Why in the world would they do that? They give two reasons. Number one, they say they don't want to give any child an advantage over another child. And number two, they say they don't want to force a gender identity onto those children before they're ready. Now, this will be the same state that cannot physically make up its mind on the topic of same-sex marriage. You guys know, just about every other month, they seem to go back and forth, don't they? But folks, I want to bring to mind for just a moment where our nation is with this particular abomination. For instance, I think all of us in here recognize Massachusetts was the very first state to legalize same-sex marriage. Let me point out something to you that ought to shame every single one of us in this room. Do you realize while Massachusetts was the first to legalize it, we know that places like Greece and Rome, they also had it, didn't they? But do you realize we were the first to legalize it? We were the first nation in the history of nations to legalize same-sex marriage. They were then followed behind by Connecticut in the year 2008. Iowa, 2009. Iowa of all places, folks. That's a heartland state. 2009 actually opened up the door because then you've got Maine, you've got New Hampshire, you've got Vermont. Folks, if you're keeping track, that's 7 states in our union. That's more than a tenth of our union. Has basically looked at what is an abomination to God and said, we don't care, we're going to do it our way. Now let's get back to that biblical worldview for just a moment. How many of our children are being taught tolerance? And they believe that that is precisely the way we should be. Tolerate every belief, every activity. And yet the one thing that we're intolerant of in this nation is God, Christianity. For instance, we go to Wisconsin where a young girl, Morgan Nyman, 8 years old, Valentine's Day comes around, they're passing out Valentine cards. Lo and behold, she gets in trouble because her Valentine card says Jesus loves you on the front of it. Or we go to Omaha, Nebraska, where a young man, he got in trouble because he wanted to study his Bible during free time, study hall. Yet he was told he couldn't do that. We go to Denver, Colorado, where an elementary school principal walked into an elementary school library and of all the books to remove, guess which one he took out? The Bible. Folks, I was doing a meeting. I normally don't do meetings through the week because that takes me out of the office. But I was up in Alaska and I was doing a meeting Sunday through Wednesday. Monday evening, I was standing up front and a young man came up to me. He said, Dr. Harab, he said, you were right. I said, what's that? He said, I went to our school library today. He said, I found all kind of books on the occult. He said, I found books on Satan worship, on Wicca. But he said, I couldn't find a Bible. So I went to our librarian and I asked her, I said, where's the Bible? He said, she looked me in the face and said, that book is not allowed in this building. Now, folks, think about that for just a moment. You've got an elementary school principal in Colorado, in Denver, removing the Bible out of a library. And yet, I want you to think with me for just a moment. There is a school that sits in a suburb of Denver. I was there about 2 months ago. In fact, every single person in here recognizes the school. You may not recognize it from that particular picture, but if I show you the name of it, I suspect we all remember Columbine, do we not? Or maybe we go down to Houston, Texas. Houston, Texas, where two sisters are caught walking down the hallway with Bibles. They're rebuked. Teacher actually took them to the principal's office. Now, in my day, you go to the principal's office, that was a pretty serious offense, folks. She called her mom, wanted to call Child Protective Services. And when mom gets there, she picks up the Bible, she throws it into the trash can saying, "This is garbage." Now, folks, that's where we are today. So as you're thinking about your worldview, your child's worldview, I need you to understand, do your children really have a biblical worldview? Because you see, the way I see it is outside of these four walls, we're sending them into an area that is definitely a secular worldview. And it's not just outside of these four walls. I suspect some of you in this room have actually been evolutionized, so to speak. And you don't even know it. By that I mean you've kind of bought into some of these things and it quite literally doesn't even enter your head. Let me give you a quick test. Let's say your child comes home to you, they're carrying a picture book, maybe it's your grandchild. They come up and they grab you by the leg, they sit you down on the couch, crawl up in your lap, and they want you to read this story to them. And so without even thinking, you open it up to page one. Here's a question. Did you even look at the title? It says prehistoric. You know what prehistoric means? Before man. Now let's think about that for just a moment. Let's go back to 1766 and let's look in the dictionary and ask ourselves this question. Is the word prehistoric in the dictionary? The answer? No. All right, we go to 1860 to Noah Webster's very first dictionary. Let's ask the same question. Is the word prehistoric in the dictionary? Answer, no. You know why? Because folks, at that point, they didn't believe there was time before man. In fact, the reason I showed you this one, 1860, it was 1859 when a gentleman by the name of Charles Darwin penned a little book called On the Origin of Species. And that was quite literally the beginning, so to speak. So as you're thinking about what your children really are learning, and you're thinking about what they're developing as their worldview, what I want to do for just a minute is I want to give you six Bible verses that will help you hopefully teach them a biblical worldview. In fact, if you got pen and paper, let me encourage you, jot a few of these down. Share these with your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers. Because folks, if you think about it for just a moment, this is where we got to start. Because if our kids get the fact that yes, there is a God and the Bible is His Word, then all of a sudden, everything else becomes a whole lot easier. Before I give you those six verses, let me share with you a very quick story. Albert Einstein walked into a setting very similar to this. He shuffled his feet in. It was a night class that he was teaching. You can just imagine for just a moment being able to sit at the feet of Albert Einstein. He shuffles all the way to the front of the room. He's carrying his papers. He sits his papers down. He turns around. He addresses the class. He says, "Today I'd like for us to set aside what was planned in the syllabus." And you can imagine everybody's listening to him. He said, "What I'd like for us to talk about is something that has plagued me my entire life." And so by this time, the entire class, quite literally, they are on the edge of their seats. They're wanting to know, what has this genius been thinking about? What has plagued him? So he asked the question. He said, "I want you to tell me, what do you think is the quantum sum of all the knowledge that man has about the universe?" And basically he was asking them this: how much do you think we know of everything that's out there? Young man very quickly raises his hand, calls on him. He says, "Dr. Einstein, I believe we have amassed about 80% of knowledge of all there is to know." Einstein quite literally did not even acknowledge the young man. The class, being perceptive, realized he didn't like that answer. Another young man tested the waters and said, I believe it will be about 60%. To which Einstein kind of nodded. And they realized he liked this downward trend. And so the hands began to go up. We got 50%. We got 40%. Finally, a young lady in the very, very back of the room, she raised her hand. She said, Dr. Einstein, I believe it would be less than 20%. She said, I think the true amount that we have known about this universe is less than 20%. And it was at that point that Einstein finally smiled. Now, folks, I want us to be honest for just a moment. Jehovah God knows everything, correct? We don't know a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what God knows, correct? Then maybe somebody could tell me why it is we put more allegiance in textbooks than we do this book. I mean, let's be honest, folks. We put a whole lot more allegiance in man-written books than we do the one book that is inspired by God. So if I'm going to teach you a biblical worldview, if we're going to study about things like how old is the earth, you know what we got to do? First thing we got to do is we got to start with His Word. Why would we do that? Because we don't know a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what God knows. And then we look at His world. Because ultimately what we see in the world is going to agree with what? What we read in His Word. Here's your six verses. Verse number one, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, if we want to develop a true biblical worldview, if we want to know how old the earth is, this is where we got to start, folks. Because if you can't trust the first verse, why in the world would you trust anything to follow? Somebody says, Brad, that's nice and all, but exactly when was the beginning? Well, let's keep reading. Colossians chapter 1, verse 16. For by Him were all things created that are in heaven, that are in the earth. Paul here, writing to the church at Colossae, reminding us that it was a creation event and that everything in heaven and earth was created by God. Verse number 3. Matthew 19, verse 4. He answered and he said unto them, Have you not read that He which made them at the beginning made them male and female? All right, folks, I've only given you three verses, but I want you to look already at what we've got. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. It was a creation event. Now we know there's males and females there from the beginning. In fact, in Mark chapter 10, verse 6, Jesus puts it this way. He says, But from the beginning of creation, God made the male and female. And folks, let's stop right there for just a second. Evolution is teaching our kids the earth is 4.6 billion, with a B, years old. And they're telling our kids that man's only been here for 3 million years. And yet Jesus Christ said, but from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. As I said, you got one of two choices. You can believe a man-made theory that's got all kind of problems with it, or you can believe the words of the Son of God. Verse number 5, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 45. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 45, he actually names that first man. If you got your Bible, flip open there with me. So it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam became a quickening spirit. Who's that first Adam he's talking about there? That'd be Adam of Adam and Eve, would it not? Who's the second Adam? That's Jesus Christ, folks. Now think about that for just a moment. You've got Paul referring to these two Adams as real historical people. If you discount the first Adam, what are you doing to the second? The last verse that I would give to you is Genesis chapter 3, verse 20. Adam called his wife's name Eve because she was the mother of all living. Telling us all the lineage of humanity is coming through who? Eve. Now, friends, with those six Bible passages in mind, here's what you can do. You can sit down with a friend. You can sit down with a neighbor or a coworker. You can open up your Bible to Genesis chapter 5, and you can begin showing them the age of the earth and this biblical worldview I'm talking about. Now, you guys already know just from last night that I'm a very visual learner. So if I'm going to do this, the way that I do it is I'm actually going to build a timeline. And I'm going to open the Bible and I'm going to start reading to somebody. Genesis chapter 5, verse 3. Adam lived 130 years. He begot a son. He called his name Seth. So we drop 130 on our timeline and then we keep reading in that same book. Genesis chapter 5. Verse 6, Seth lived 105 years. He begat Enos. We add 105 to it. We're up to 235, and we keep reading. Enos lived 90 years. He begat Canaan. We add 90 to it. We're up to 325. And folks, suddenly what we can do is we can actually build a timeline that is telling us the age of the earth. You say, Brad, how in the world can you say that? Because in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. It was a creation event. There were males and females there from the beginning. First male's name was Adam. I'm just giving you his lineage, folks. And you look at me and you say, but surely there are holes or there's gaps in those genealogies. Again, if you've got your Bible, flip open to the New Testament book of Jude. Remember, it's right before the book of Revelation. I always want to tease people and say, turn to the fourth chapter of Jude. There's only one. Verse 14 of Jude says this. Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men also saying, behold, the Lord comes with 10,000 of his saints. So we've got a New Testament inspired writer who is talking about Enoch being the seventh. So we go back to Genesis chapter 5, or we just look up here on the chart. And lo and behold, there's Enoch, folks. And guess what? He's the seventh. Which tells me if you're going to put gaps or holes in the genealogies, it's going to have to come after Enoch. And I promise you, as I'm looking out at you, there's not enough gaps or holes in the world to fit evolutionary time into this thing. Now, as you're looking at that, let me show you something that some of you probably have not ever thought about. The vertical line that I just dropped on the screen, do you realize everybody to the left of that line, they could have had a face-to-face conversation with Adam because they were living as contemporaries. Now think about that for just a minute. You've got Lamech, Noah's dad, could have walked up to him and said, what was it like to be in a covenant relationship with God? What was it like to be in that garden? But the one that even impresses me a little bit more than that, if you keep your eye on Noah, I'm going to slide him up to the top of the screen. So now we got Noah here, his son Shem. You realize everybody to the left of that arrow, they could have looked Shem in the face and asked him, what was it like before the flood? And folks, you're now talking about men like Abraham and Isaac. They could have looked him in the eyes and said, what was it like? You see, if you want to lay a biblical worldview in the heart and the mind of your kids, what you have to do, folks, is you got to start with a man named Adam. And you go to us today. You see, I don't think it was a mistake that the Bible gives us the genealogy from Adam to Christ. You realize you can do the math, and in round numbers, these are approximate numbers, but in round numbers, it's roughly 4,000 years from Adam to Christ. Now, here's a question. Do we know how long it's been since Jesus walked the earth? Well, let's see. Since we use a calendar system that goes by when he was on the earth, you ever heard the words BC or AD? Do you know what that hinges on? Well, let's see. AD is Latin for in the year of our Lord. We're living in the year 2010 AD. So it's been, in round numbers, roughly 2,000 years, hasn't it? So I can stand up here and tell you, according to the Bible, the earth is roughly 6,000 years old. Now I'm going to prove that to you after we come back from our break. But what I want us to do for just a minute is I want us to talk about this change. How did we get here? And in order to do that, what I want you to do is I want you to mentally, for just a minute, walk back in time. For some of you, you're not going to be able to do this because you're too young, but there's a bunch of you in here that can go back to the 50s. Some of you can go back before the 50s. I want you to imagine walking down the hallway, 50s and 60s, and going into a classroom and asking one of those teachers, what is your biggest problem or complaint? Reader's Digest did this. You can find the survey online. You know what the number one complaint of teachers was in the 1950s and 60s? It was chewing gum. Chewing gum. Followed behind by things like littering, running down the hallway, remember those days? Breaking in line, that would probably be at lunchtime. I will point out they did have smoking, but I'd also point out that it was cigarettes and not some other substance. But folks, think with me for just a moment. Let's go down the hallway of the local high school. And we walk into those same classrooms, we look the teacher in the eye, and we ask them this question, what's your biggest complaint today? You think they're going to say chewing gum? Folks, I don't think chewing gum is going to make the list. Because we've got teachers now that are worried about their personal safety. They realize that discipline, that respect has been thrown out the window. That there is drugs, there's violence. In fact, in some school systems, we put metal detectors up. We've got drug dogs that are walking around the lockers. They're walking around outside. Now let me make sure the older men in this room really get what I'm saying. There are some men in this room that used to drive to high school in a pickup truck with a gun in a rack in that truck. Because after school, you know what you were going to go do? Go hunting. Do you realize if you did that today, you would be on Fox News? Because there's a zero tolerance policy today. And folks, here's the question, and don't miss this. You take a 15-year-old from the 1950s and a 15-year-old from today. Anatomically speaking, is there any difference at all? Folks, they're just alike. So what has changed? Because obviously something dramatically has changed. We've gone from chewing gum being the greatest problem to drugs, to violence. I would say that it's our attitude towards God and the fact that we have removed Him out of our schools and out of our society. You see, the three pillars of Christianity that I believe all Christians must be able to prove. Number one, we got to be able to prove that His Word really is inspired. Number two, we have to be able to prove that He really does exist. And number three, we got to be able to prove that Jesus Christ really was the Son of God. You know, we can't take what Oprah Winfrey would say, that there are multiple ways to heaven. Because folks, the Bible says Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father except through Him. If that is correct, which it is, then that excludes every other way. So let's think about this for just a moment. I think everybody in this room would agree with me that matter exists today. I mean, you're sitting on pews, we've got carpet under our feet, there's a building over our head protecting us from the rain. If you're in this room and you don't believe matter exists and you think that all of this is a hallucination, you got bigger problems than we can work on those later. But folks, think with me for just a moment. If matter exists today, do you realize that means that something has to be eternal? You say, Brad, why do you say that? Because can you ever get something from nothing? Nope. So let me give you one more math equation. Number one, something exists today, thus something must be eternal. It's always existed. Number two, something is eternal, meaning it doesn't wear down, it's not wearing out. That means it violates scientific laws. Because according to science, everything is wearing out. It's running down. Number three, something violates scientific laws. Thus, it is outside the observable laws of naturalistic science. Now, folks, you may not like my math, but the fact that there is matter here today proves there is an eternal God. And now we're going to look at how exactly we can prove that. How do we identify it? For instance, if I were an atheist and I walk in here and I say, hey, I want you to prove to me that there really is a God. How do we do that? Now, before you just cast it off on a preacher or an elder, moms, dads, listen to me very carefully. If you can't prove there's a God, how in the world do you expect your child to? Atheist websites are absolutely just flourishing out there, trying to get our kids. This is one I grabbed. It says, no God, no guilt. The belief in God awakens fanaticism and guilt. Live free and responsible. De-baptize yourself. Which I'm assuming involves a hairdryer. But folks, think about it for just a moment. If I asked you, in all honesty, I said, hey, can you prove to me that Abraham Lincoln is real? Because there's nobody in this room that saw him. There is nobody in this room that's 200 years old. Or for those of you who have never been overseas, how do you know for sure that there really is a Great Wall of China? And you say, well, Brad, wait just a second. We've got pictures of Abraham Lincoln. We've got writings of him. We can get in our car. We can go see his childhood home here in Kentucky. And as for the Great Wall of China, folks, you put me on a computer that has internet access, and within about 2 minutes, I can be zooming down looking at it from a satellite. We got proof. But let's be honest for just a moment. God is a spirit, isn't he? The Bible says, those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Okay, here's problem number one. Our kids are being told that you need to be able to use what we call the scientific method to prove anything. Scientific method basically says this. You need to be able to touch it, taste it, hear it, smell it, or feel it. And then go into a lab, repeat your findings before something is real. Where does that leave God? You see, our kids are learning a method that actually disproves God. So the question is, how do we make sure our children know that, yes, there really is a God? What I want to do very quickly is I want to give you some arguments that we need to teach our children, our grandchildren, that prove there really is a God. Cosmologic argument, the anthropological argument, the teleological, big funny looking words, but they're very simple arguments when you think about it. Let me show you the first one. I love this one. Let's say that one of my four children comes up to me and says, you know, Dad, you talk about God every weekend, but we've never seen him. How do we know for sure that there really is a God? What I'm going to do is I'm going to walk them outside. I'm going to point up to the night sky, and I'm simply going to say, you see all that stuff out there? How'd it get there? Where'd it come from? Because you see, my kids can see the moon. They can see the stars. They know that it exists, so the question is, all right, where did it come from? We've only got three possibilities. Option number one, the universe is eternal. And by that I mean the universe has always been here in the present state, and it will forever be here. That's option number one. Option number two is it's not eternal, but rather it just popped into existence from nothing. So I want you to do this for me. Clear your mind of everything, imagine nothing, and then assume the universe popped into existence from that nothing. It's option number two. Option number three is, it's not eternal, it didn't create itself, but rather it was created by something superior to it. There's our three options. Let's look at each one for just a moment. Hopefully you noticed the images I'm using in this part of the slide. That right there is a spiral galaxy. And the reason I'm using that picture is because that galaxy is actually spiraling outwards. That picture by itself disproves the idea of an eternal universe. Because we know the universe is actually expanding. It had a beginning. And the two men that confirmed this beyond the shadow of a doubt, you probably recognize their names. Edwin Hubble, of Hubble Telescope fame, and a fellow by the name of Albert Einstein. They proved that things were actually moving. In fact, it was Hubble who detected what we call red shift. Option number one, it's unscientific, and even evolutionists recognize that. Listen to what Robert Jastrow had to say when it talks about the eternality of the universe. He said, the lingering decline predicted by astronomers for the end of the world differs from the explosive conditions that they have calculated for its birth. But the impact is the same. Notice this. Modern science denies an external existence to the universe, either in the past or the future. Option number one is no good. It's unscientific. Now that only leaves us two. If you're an atheist, how many options you got left? Just one. If you're an atheist, you basically have to take the position everything came into existence from what? Nothing. And folks, if you are sitting in here tonight and you honestly think you can get something from nothing, I want to see you out in the foyer because I'd like to sell you some nothing. All right, don't you think Walmart would have it on sale for $5.99? We got some nothing for you. Folks, here's what they do. In the textbooks, and you can check me on this, they try to shrink it down to a very small point in space. To a minuscule little point, they blow some smoke in our children's face. Hope they don't see through it. And try to explain it that away. Let me show you what I mean by that. Alan Guth was given an interview in Omni magazine. He was asked the question, how big was this very early pre-inflation universe? In other words, how big was everything before the Big Bang? Look at his answer. He said, amazingly small, about 10 to the minus 24 centimeters across. Smaller, he says, than a proton. Also amazing, it would have contained only about 25 pounds of matter. What's my next question? Where'd the 25 pounds come from? Because, folks, he hasn't explained the existence of the universe. All he did was shrink it down to 25 pounds. Which you can look around this room and realize there's more than 25 pounds of mass in here. In fact, some of us could shed 25 pounds and we'd be a lot better off. Folks, think about that for just a moment. That only leaves you one logical explanation for how the universe even got here. It's a self-evident truth that nothing produces nothing in view of this. Since something now exists, it must follow that something has existed forever. That something was responsible for the creation of the universe. That something, folks, is Jehovah God. Very first way that we prove that there is a God is we walk outside, we point up to the night sky, and we simply say, where did all that stuff come from? NASA astronomer John O'Keefe, he put it this way. He said, we are, by astronomical standards, a pampered, cosseted, cherished group of creatures. He said, if the universe had not been made with the most exacting precision, we could have never come into existence. It is my view that these circumstances indicate that the universe was created for man to live in. Number two, how do we prove there's a God? By morals. Are we all in agreement that morals exist? Yeah. Believe it or not, atheists will admit that morals exist, and here's why I know that. I get a chance to email back and forth with atheists on a fairly regular basis. When I go speak on university campuses, they'll come up to me and we'll share emails. One of the very first questions I'll ask an atheist is this. Would you mind if I come to your house, rob you blind, and kill your family? You know what every single one of them has said so far when I asked that question? They don't want me doing that. You know why? Because they view it as wrong. They see certain behaviors as right and wrong. Now let's think about it. If you look at that list on the screen for just a moment, those are behaviors that we view as, quote unquote, wrong. But folks, in order for something to be wrong, that means there has to be a standard for what is right and what is wrong. Where do we get the standard from? This time we only got two options. Option number one, we got it from God. Option number two, we got it from man. If you're an atheist, how many options you got? This time they only got one, because they don't believe in a God. So atheists will say, I don't want you coming to my house, stealing my stuff, killing my family. That's wrong. Okay, what makes it wrong? Well, man does. Okay, what's the problem with saying that man makes something right or wrong? Question is, who gets to decide? Which man gets to say that this is right and this is wrong? Anybody ever heard of Hitler, Stalin? Folks, do you realize in Hitler's mind, he thought he was doing the right thing. He thought he was perfecting the human race. And in the process of doing that, he extinguished millions of Jews. But in his mind, he thought he was doing right. Let me give you just a modern day example. I'll pick on Mark. Mark and I hear about a job. Pays $500,000. All the job is testing hammocks all day long. 8 hours a day, and you get paid $500,000. Now, we both want the job. And we both have an interview on Monday. He's got an interview at 12. I've got one at 1:30. Now, I'm nervous because I think Mark's probably got more experience at this than I do. So about 11 o'clock on Monday, I go and I slit all four of his tires. He misses his interview. I make mine. I get the job. What's the problem? Because in my sight, that would be okay. That'd be good. I got the job. And yet, I think everybody in here recognizes the fact that that behavior is wrong. The problem with saying that man evolved ethics and morals is that each person would view right and wrong a little bit differently. So the only option that makes logical sense is that we have adopted God's unchanging standard for what is right and what is wrong. Folks, you may not like it, but those are the facts. We know that He is eternal, He is holy, He is just and righteous, He is forever consistent. In fact, whatever He does, commands, or approves is ultimately for our good. So the second way that I can prove there's a God is the very existence of morals. The fact that we do have a right and a wrong. Number three is design. Anytime you have design, by definition, what must you have? A designer. I'll share with you very quickly. I was in a debate in New Zealand. My very first debate was televised. Nervous as a cat. 3-hour televised debate. It was a surgeon. He was an atheist. And about midway through the debate, I decided I was going to set this guy up. And so I started asking him a series of questions that I knew he couldn't answer. I said, Dr. Joe, would you mind telling the TV audience out there where the original matter for the universe came from? He kind of sunk his head a little bit. He said, well, we don't know that yet. I said, oh, don't, no worries. How about this one? Could you maybe tell the TV audience then how we went from that rock-like material to the first living cell? And he kind of shrunk his shoulders even further, and he said, well, we don't know that either. I said, oh, no problem. Maybe you could then tell the TV audience how that first cell self-assembled. Because I said, I think I remember something in science about everything moving towards disorder. So how do you get all these parts coming together in an ordered fashion? Folks, I kid you not, by this time he was looking at the floor. He just said, we don't know that yet. And I asked him about 3 or 4 more questions just like that. And then I switched gears on him and I said, hey, Dr. Joe, do you know about the brachial plexus? It's a nerve plexus. It sits right under your armpit. It's pretty big. It actually looks like a very, very, very large spider web. It's one of the biggest nerve plexus in your body. He perks back up. He says, yes, I know about the brachial plexus. I said, so you've actually seen this complex network of nerves. He balked up. He said, absolutely. He said, I've even done surgery on it. I said, so you telling me that you have seen firsthand the design in this nerve plexus? He said, yes, I've seen the design. And as soon as it left his lips, he realized what he just admitted to. Because folks, if there is design, there must be designer. You think about the universe for just a moment. Do we see design, for instance, and just trying to get the earth where it is? I told you guys I'm not a math person, but I want to show you one slide to kind of impress upon you for just a moment. What are the statistical odds that it would take to get a heavenly body in just the right place in space? For instance, what are the odds of being in the right type of galaxy? You know, we're in a spiral galaxy within the Milky Way. Odds are 1 in 7. All right, what are the odds of being in the right location within that galaxy? Meaning not too far out on one of those spiral arms or not too close to the center. 0.05 to the fifth billion. All right, what about being near the right sun? That is one that's not flaming up or flaming out. Odds, 1 in 100. What about the right distance from that sun? Because folks, not only do you have to be near the right type of sun, you've got to have the right distance. And that one, 1 in 40. The right rotation rate. A rotation rate that would allow for springtime and harvest, 1 in 4. The right tilt, 1 in 360. You add all of that up, and the number you see at the bottom is the statistical odds of getting a heavenly body in the right place. That's off the charts. And folks, we don't have life yet. Now think about that. All you've done there is put a heavenly body in the right place in space. You've still got to add water. Or what about that sun? You know, you think with me for just a moment. Within every congregation of Christians that I visit, there's a little fight that goes on. We don't talk about it much in the church. We don't like to air our laundry. But I suspect it's even happening here. And that fight has to do with a little box on the back wall that usually some poor deacon has control over. And he can either do one of two things. He can make the ladies happy and have the men sweating. Or he can make the men happy and have all of the women very upset with him. Now, folks, think about this. We can't set the temperature for a room to please everybody, and yet God, Jehovah God, set the temperature for the sun 93 million miles away perfectly for this earth. I'm going to take about 4 more minutes of your time, and what I want to do is I want to give you 7 quick proofs of how we prove there's a God. Proof number one, some of these are going to be a repeat, but I think you'll understand why I'm doing this. Number one, every creation must have a creator. Hebrews chapter 3, verse 4, for every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. Colossians 1:16, all things were created through him and for him. We know matter exists. So where did it come from? Proof number two, every design must have a designer. We talked just a little bit about the fact that you can't have design in the universe, but folks, you also cannot have design in the human body without there being a designer. Proof number three, codes require somebody to program the code. You say, what are you talking about, Brad? Carl Sagan, very well-known atheist, several years back made the comment, he said, if we ever receive a code from outer space, that demands that there's intelligent life out there. And as such, our government, we're spending loads of money on what's called the SETI program, the search for extraterrestrial life out in space. And yet, folks, I want you to think about something. Every single one of us in this room, you've got a code in every cell of your body. It's called DNA. It took us 13 years to unravel that code. Millions of dollars, hundreds of labs. And yet we would say that that doesn't demand intelligence. Proof number four, is known as the law of cause and effect, and it simply reads like this. For every material effect, there must be an adequate cause that existed prior to that effect. In other words, if I told you, hey, that frog just caused a tsunami wave, you would say, Brad, that is not a big enough cause to make that effect. All right, what caused the universe? You say, whoa, what caused God? Go back and reread the actual law. For every material effect, God is a spirit, is he not? He's actually outside of that scientific law. Let me just throw this in real quick. Richard Dawkins' favorite crutch is to say, okay, well, then where did God come from? And he beats Christians over the head thinking that he's got a good argument. And he's wanting somebody to say, well, you know, maybe God came from X. Well, if you tell him God came from X, what's his next question? Where'd X come from? It's an argument ad infinitum, meaning it would go on forever. Folks, the problem is Richard Dawkins is too ignorant to understand the concept of eternality. The fact that material is here today means something has been here forever. That's God. That means he doesn't have a beginning. Proof number five, laws require a lawgiver. James chapter 4, verse 12, there's one lawgiver who's able to save and to destroy. Folks, everybody in this room, whether you like it or not, you recognize the fact that there are physical laws. Like when you got up this morning, you put your feet out of the bed, you expected them to go down, didn't you? And not up. Because we know about the law of gravity. Or we know about the laws of momentum. Okay, we all recognize there's laws. Who was the lawgiver? Because laws don't just happen. We've already talked about morals, a moral code. We have a moral code. Where did it come from? We talked about the fact that certain behaviors are wrong, and the only option that makes logical sense is that we've adopted God's unchanging standard. Number seven is communication requires a communicator. I think oftentimes we take it for granted that man is the only creature that can actually build on knowledge. And a lot of times people will say, well, you know, parrots can talk. Parrots can mimic. But can they build on knowledge? How many parents do you know of that their kids say, you know what, I really don't want to live like this. I think I'd like central heat and air in the nest. And then the next generation says, you know what, I think I'd like cable TV. Now, every single generation of parents lives exactly the same. Birds continue to build nests, do they not? How many birds have you ever seen that build an awning over their nest to keep them dry? They don't do that. I'll give you the classic example. My car that died on me last year was a Volvo sedan. I bought it because I was told at that time that was the safest car on the road and I do a lot of traveling. The guy went through, I bet he spent 12 minutes telling me all of the safety features of this car, and he began to point out all of these bags. He says, it's got a canopy, it's got the side impact, it's got the front. He said, it's actually got an encapsulated thing. I told my wife, I said, I want to roll the car just to see all this stuff. Do you think Henry Ford ever envisioned an airbag or a DVD player or a GPS in a car? We can build on knowledge, can we not? Who gave us that ability? Jehovah God. Here's how to really land it for you. They spent a week of my life, one of the most wasted weeks of my life. I was in a general biology class. They taught us that man crawled down out of the trees. We evolved an upright stance and all of the muscles needed because of our food supply was getting short, and so we needed to go out into the plains. For a week, they tried to indoctrinate us with this idea. Now, I know a little bit about human anatomy, folks, and to go from walking on all fours to walking uprightly, you know how many muscle changes you got to have? It'd be a whole lot easier to evolve a voice box. So why in the world haven't animals evolved a voice box that only has basically four main muscles, they're little bitty, where they could say, hey, you know what? Hadn't rained lately. Let's go over here to the savannah where there's other trees that are plentiful. But no, we're going to evolve biped locomotion so we can walk across the plain. When you really start looking at it, folks, we got all kinds of proof that there really is a God. So I hope when you think about those main questions of life, where did you come from? Why are you here? Where are you going when you die? I hope that when you step out into eternity, you've made the right choice about why you're here. We're going to take about a 20-minute break, let you guys get up, stretch, reload on some sugar, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk a little bit about the age of the earth. Thank you for your attention.